poopy.
This is Mystery History Theater. I left it off last time in my attempt to look in the New York Tribune, the April 24th edition, which was, it was a Monday, to look for some kind of blurb that mentioned Booth's diary had been found at Gambo Creek. I couldn't find that. It wasn't the first edition that I was looking. There may have been a second edition, but understandably, if this was a late insertion, they'd have to stick it somewhere where they could find a spot for it or make a spot for it. I mean, I would put that on the front page and have a little bold-faced headline or box it off and draw some attention to it, even if you couldn't go on about it, because not a lot was known. But this would still be worth, I think, breaking news. I don't know. All I know is they didn't find it. That's not as critical as is the fact that a diary was found. And we talked about, I'm not really sure we talked about who found it. It was an Indian tracker by the name of Whippet Nalgai from the Pamunkey tribe, which was throughout Virginia and North Carolina. He was an excellent tracker. He was at Gambo Creek, and he found a number of items left there. I don't remember I enumerated them, but I will now. Let's see. It says, early on Sunday, April 23rd, the detectives were scouring the Virginia side of the Potomac and had broken their search with a halt at King George Courthouse. Nalgai continued to scout on his own. Before midday, he was back with a collection of articles he had found in the grass near Gambo Creek, a bloodstained ulsterette, which is a kind of a duster, if you are familiar with watching more authentic Western movies, kind of long type coats. This is a smaller version of that. It's called an ulsterette. That was found, a pistol, a compass, and two near-empty brandy bottles, as well as a wallet containing $2,100 in Union currency, several letters of credit on Canadian and British banks, and a diary with a small map and six pictures of women tucked into its inside pocket. Now, again, this situation is so absolutely filthy. You could go on forever. And maybe I'll go back to it another day, but what I want to finish is all that really needs to be said or demonstrated with regard to Booth not being the one shot in Garrett's barn. I may mention this before, that most likely, and this is from testimony of some of the troops that were there, and that was Boyd shot himself. He knew he was done and he shot himself. Good old Boston Corbett was made the hero and he wore it, but he was an individual that was a bit unhinged and didn't really comport himself any better in the years after the Civil War, but probably because he was living a lie. Conger did not shoot him. Daugherty didn't shoot Boyd. Baker didn't shoot Boyd. A number of troopers said he shot himself. All they had to do, this forensics about the entry of the bullet wound, it could not have been shot from where Corbett was. On the elevation that Corbett was on at the time, the entry of the bullet, the exit of the bullet, you know, could have been all been demonstrated. Could have grabbed Boyd's revolver, which one should have had, I guess, a little heat in it, maybe even smoking at that time, and or else had a chamber or two with no bullet in it. And that may have been done, but it's all been lost. The same thing with identifying the body, and we'll get to that just a little bit later. I'm not going to go on about it, but. You know, everyone went on about, well, Booth had JWB initials on his arm, tattooed kind of. Well, that's the case. Boom, take a look. Now, even Boyd had the same initials, but we're not talking about Boyd here. Booth himself should have had those initials on him, on his forearm, I believe it was. And that could have been it. So, you know, what about that? Nothing has ever been said. The photographs taken by, I believe it's an Alex Gardner, who after the Civil War kind of went out west, never to be not seen from again, but out of the limelight, didn't want to know anything about it, and never really talked about it. But my point is, it's the same with thing with everything. When you get involved with the government trying to cover up, if they've got the goods to prove their story, they'll show it. If they don't, they'll just tell you, well, you know, something happened, and it's all about, you know, top secret, national security, and you can't see it. That's, come on, man, it's bullshit. So that would have done it, but nobody said a thing about it. And like I said, I'll read from W.C. Jameson's Boopy on the Grave for another synopsis of what I'm referring to. So the thing is, they could have decided that then, and that was never even mentioned. And the photographs that were taken were never even shown. Hey, if you got the body laying out on the table, you got the arm there, it's all done. You got him. You see that? That's him. Never happened. Nobody saw the pictures. All right, now there's something else that went on. I mean, you've got a number of politicians who are now pissing their pants because they know that they've been mentioned in, or could have been mentioned in Booth's diary. And by the way, Boyd had a diary also. And I'll read something about Boyd's diaries, possibly, or diaries, and may have been more damning than Booth's. But Booth makes it back, and this is the end of a particular chapter about finding this these articles. Let's see, it said, okay, still more convincing evidence that Booth's diary arrived in Washington 3 days before the body said to be his could have been found in the Army Medical Museum. Dr. Edward Curtis ran the photomicrographic department, which in the museum's 2 years of existence already housed thousands of photographs of human tissue salvaged from hospitals and battlefields. Five pictures of women found in Booth's diary was taken to the museum, where Curtis's job was to have his hospital stewards make prints of them from mounting on cardboard. A six picture, a tintype, vanished. The 3-inch by 4-inch glass negatives were soon in NDP possession. That's National Detective Police. Each was marked with, and this is what was on these slides, if you will, NDP, E period, C period, 4-24-65, right? April 24th, 1865. The E period, C period were the doctor's initials. The date, April 24th, 1865. These plates still exist with two of the pictures wrongly identified by a visitor at the War Department, and the error perpetuated ever since. The women are Kate Scott and Isola Booth. But the most significant factor is the original markings, material proof that Booth's diary was in Washington on April 24th, 1865, thanks to the diligence of the Pamunkey Indian Scout, Whippet Nalgai. Now, you might say, well, heck, I mean, they could have found his diary. And, yeah, well, what's the big deal? He gets shot a couple of days later. So what's the big deal about that? He left it behind. They caught him 2 days later. They shot and killed him. So what? Well, so what is this? Boy being shot at Garrett, well, dying at Garrett's farm, also had a diary that was taken off his body and presumed to be Booth's diary because they thought they had Booth. They were in different colored bindings. So now we have, okay, what do we have now? We have Booth having more than one diary. Now, the one that was sent back to Washington, the one that they're talking about, days before Boyd and his diary were brought back, had about 19 pages excised from it, 18 or 19 pages. Stanton said, oh, you know, that's the way I got it. You know, it lies all up and down the road, okay? The thing is, the pages were missing. And why were the pages missing? Because they were damning to the people in high places that knew what was going on, namely Stanton. And Stanton was in an all-fired rush to try to turn the onus of this assassination on the Confederate government, which had nothing to do with it. So Stanton not only served his own purpose by deflecting any kind of focus on him and other politicians, but it also made his vindictive feelings towards the Confederacy substantiated. Therefore, as he very badly wanted to do, and Lincoln didn't, and that was bring in Reconstruction and pound the snot out of the South for as long as they could. That's what he wanted done. That's what a lot of them wanted done. That's why they hated Lincoln for bringing the war to a swift end, even though it was brutal. So there were two goals accomplished by Stanton pointing the finger at the Confederate government and not at himself, my goodness. And I think that's what that's why it's always been looked at, Booth has always been looked at as being this zealot for the South. And he wasn't. Now, I'm sure he may not have liked Lincoln and the Union, but, this guy was in New York more than Lincoln was. He was in Pennsylvania where he had oil holdings. He was up in Canada. I mean, he regularly went back and forth. We've already talked about him and Lowell Alexander, one of his paramours, being in Rhode Island. He would go up to see her in Manhattan. This guy was just making money. Booth was about one thing only. Booth. And that's all there was to it. He made money no matter what. And he might have had ill feelings towards the Union, but Booth's own granddaughter, Isola Forrester, who apparently was a pretty decent journalist in her day. She was born in November 1878, died March 6, 1944. She was a journalist, and she also was a screenwriter out in Hollywood. But she wrote, I guess her last work was This One Mad Act, The Unknown Story of John Wilkes Booth and His Family by his granddaughter, published in 1937. And there supposedly was a kind of a mad strain going through that family, I believe. The acting Booths, Edwin and Junius and such, their father was... I believe alcoholic, but apparently nuts, but whatever, okay? This was not an irrational act. This is a very rational act by Booth. There's a lot of questions that will remain, and I still am not satisfied as to when he decided he was going to do this. And, again, how could certain things happen that night if it were not done at the behest of high-placed people in D.C.? That is, the gaslights going out for a period of time. I believe along the stretch of Pennsylvania Avenue that Booth would have started out riding off on and Henson behind him. The telegraph not working. The sentries at the Navy Yard Bridge being given a password and a counter password. This doesn't happen unless there's a conspiracy afoot. Come on. Stop. I also read something else. This is intriguing but not necessarily accurate in one of the newspapers of the day that conjectured that on April 14th, 1865, for that particular play, my American cousin, all other boxes, besides the one that Lincoln and his very small entourage occupied, had been bought up earlier by kind of persons unknown. What does that mean necessarily? Well, obviously it wasn't like, okay, Abe and wife and Rathbone and his fiance, we got this over here for you, but that's all we could find. That's not going to happen. It's a presidential box. But what would that mean? I don't know. That's why I think it might be a lot of hoopla, but I don't know. I mean, with the other assassins up in the other boxes drawing down on them, who knows? So that's something that's just not going to be ever uncovered in anyone's lifetime. So I also want to go back, because there's loose ends here, and I'm trying to remember which ones I want to knock down. But one of the things I thought was interesting with regard to that, the fact that it was Boyd that was in the barn, not Booth. And I may have read this before. You can read this account in Pittman's version of the Lincoln trial for the Lincoln assassins. But when Harold came out of the barn first, I think he told Conger, or Daugherty, one or the other, he said, that I don't know that guy to be Booth. Like, you're full of crap. And I mean, I think I read this in a couple of episodes before, and he's like, he's told me his name is Boyd. And Harold would know that would be Boyd because he got picked up and brought to where Boyd was. Now, I don't think that posse that rode out of D.C., made of National Detective Police officials, fell upon Boyd by accident, I guess. And nobody knows really what was going on with Boyd because he knows now that he may be in trouble and he's got to get himself out of there as soon as possible. So now he gets picked up on the Monday after the Friday. I mean, I'm surprised you're even there. But Harold must have known he was there. Now, the two of them are off together, and they, it's intimated that they may have been allowed to escape, because here's the thing. Stanton didn't want any of these characters alive or in the country. One of the reasons Surratt was made one of the three fugitives to be sought, right? It was about Booth, it was about Harold, and it was about Surratt. Surratt wasn't even in D.C. at the time. But Surratt knew too much, way too much. Boyd knew too much. And Stanton had given Boyd this position so that he could spy on the Confederacy. But Boyd turned around being involved with the kidnapping plot, and Stanton must have known that. Did he mind if Lincoln was going to get kidnapped? Probably not. Now, also the papers of the day talk about and fingering the Knights of the Golden Circle for being behind us right from the get-go. Knights of the Golden Circle. And in a way, they may have been right. Now, there is information to the fact that the Knights of the Golden Circle put Booth up to it and gave him a hefty amount of money, somewhere, I think, in the neighborhood of $50,000 or more. There's some, I can't nail it down at this time, and the person to whom I'm trying, with whom I'm trying to get this straightened out, is not being really forthcoming. I don't know if the individual's being coy. This is not anybody you've heard about before. It's about somebody whose work I'd like to access or at least consider real, and just not getting what I want. But there was a time years ago that I believed that the Knights of the Golden Circle had some kind of connection with Britain. If I remember it as distinctly as I did, then I don't think I misremembered something. This individual is saying something to that effect, likes to call Booth a British spy. But I can't get anything. I'm not being led to anything concrete. So, I can't say that that's the case. But I think that it's very interesting that certainly the Knights of the Golden Circle could have been behind us without a doubt. But the other thing is that Britain's got its hands all over it as well. I mean, it was already understood that Booth could make his getaway and get over to Britain. Now, why would that be okay? Wouldn't Britain turn him over? Didn't sound like it. And when Booth finally gets a false passport, assumes the identity of a John Wilkes in Indiana who had been or who was a British subject that came over to the United States and set up a housekeeping in Indiana. And they both knew each other from prior occasions, because Indiana happens to be a state that had some people in there that were connected with this whole, array of personages. Even Lola Alexander, I believe, who was this woman in New York married to an officer in the Union and boinking everybody that came through, including Andrew Johnson and Booth, and probably in Johnson's attaché or whatever you want to call it, his personal secretary, Browning. And she winds up being buried out in Indiana. So that's why Nathan Guttridge had a little bit of an inside track to this. And even Andrew Potter, who was involved in the National Detective Police, spent time in Indiana. So Nathan Guttridge had access to a lot of documents and anecdotes, personal correspondence that nobody else had to, which is one of the reasons why I think that there's such a angst directed toward them by other authors. It's like, what are you going to do? Punish them, as I've said before, for having some inside information nobody else had? That's the way it goes. They had a couple of diamonds in the rough. You didn't. So what? So what do? They denigrate them and they rip them down. So that means whatever he did, whatever they did, but Neth especially, is no good. Long live revisionist history, which is the junk in your history books that we all got gagged on from the time we could read. Now, with regard to what I was saying about another statement that would seem like nothing, but knowing what we know, so to speak, it's very, very interesting and certainly to a certain point telling. All right, this comes from the April 28th edition of the New York Tribune. Remember what I said before about where Boyd was going, and really he should have gotten his butt out of Dodge as much earlier, because he who hesitates is lunch, and he got caught. But he was on his way to Mexico. So this is from one of the stories. There were a number of accounts that were in the paper with regard to what took place at the farm, in the barn where Boyd shot himself, and the hours what transpired in the hours afterward, to include how long it took him to die on the porch, apparently, of the Garrett's house, and his body being transported back to D.C., to the ironclad, I believe it was the Montauk. All right, here it said, Booth, before he died, was apparently rational, but talked at random and contradicted himself as he had done throughout, and he said, "Tell my mother I have died for my country. You gentlemen have spoiled my fun in Mexico." All right? Why would Booth have said that? He wasn't going to Mexico. He was going to go to England. Booth seemed conscious of near approach of death, but died as frivolously and hardened as he had lived. Now, this is correct, but this is something that I believe was planted in the stories, because Boyd had a mustache when they brought his body back to D.C., where Booth had shaved. And again, if you knew the markings, fine, but that was never shown in a photo. It was just pronounced. Like, what top secret or national security thing could possibly have been compromised by showing the body and its markings? And here it said, his body was fully identified by his initials on his hand in India ink, his memorandum, books, and other papers, and by the personal recognition before and after death of the detective officers who knew him. None of them knew him. His mustache had been shaved off and had a uniform beard of 4 or 5 days. He wore a gray woolen shirt, had on I don't know what kind of pants, one cavalry, a theater top boot, which drew up about the knees, but was turned down when captured. On the other foot, he had an old shoe. His leg was bandaged where it was broken, and they said that the autopsy revealed, this is a visual thing. They didn't have to do an autopsy to see that his left leg had been the one broken, and that's true. But the boot, as far as I know, that's on display, wherever it is now in the Fourth Theater, they got the right one. It was true. It was Booth's left leg, and it was Boyd's right. But that was never talked about. Now, all this that's supposed to be the way it is, which would indicate, yes, that it was Booth, is all there in this article, and yet at the time of the autopsy, and there were more bodies autopsied, there was a couple of bodies that went through there. They don't talk about it as well. All right, we'll pick up the scenario on the Montauk, which is where the body was brought. As if aware that only believers in fairies and a flat earth could accept the goings-on aboard the USS Montauk as genuine identification, Lafayette Baker called personally upon John Frederick May to come to the Navy Yard and identify Booth, a Washington physician who had once operated on the back of the actor's neck to remove a tumor. May, quote, deemed it most prudent to obey, end of quote. His immediate words upon viewing the body that lay on a carpenter's bench, mercifully shaded by an awning, were, quote, "There is no resemblance in that corpse to Booth, nor can I believe it to be him," end of quote. Baker and Barnes stood at the doctor's side. May said that his surgery on Booth had left a particular scar. The body was turned over for a closer examination. A scar was discovered. May then said that he thought the body was Booth's, although, quote, "His appearance is very much altered, looks older, more freckled. I do not recall that he was freckled," end of quote. Pressed for more detail, May spoke again of the scar. Also, quote, "The features, which, though much changed and altered, still have the same appearance. I think I cannot be mistaken," end of quote. All right, what all did he come up with? Something of a contradiction? On the sun-baked monitor, nothing was said of a leg injury. Nothing recorded, that is. In his official autopsy report to Secretary Stanton, The Surgeon General described it in some detail. The, quote, left leg and foot were encased in an appliance of splints and bandages, upon the removal of which a fracture of the fibula, 3 inches above the ankle joint, accompanied by considerable ecchymosis, was discovered. End of quote. Shortly before his death in 1891, John May wrote a memoir that said that, quote, the right limb was greatly contused and perfectly black from a fracture of one of the long bones, end of quote. A confused researcher in the 1920s questioned May's son, also a doctor, concerning the apparent conflict. His reply was that his father was a stickler for detail. If he said that the right leg was bruised and discolored, quote, that would undoubtedly mean that it was the right leg that was broken, end of quote. The cadaver from Garrett's farm had a proclivity for disappearing acts. The cavalry had lost it en route to the Potomac River, a macabre sleight of hand repeated at the Washington Navy Yard. It was spirited off the Montauk for subsequent burial in a storage room of the Washington Arsenal, the city's old penitentiary, under the supervision of Lafayette Baker and Major Ecker. So, you know, it kind of is reminiscent once again of what happened with Kennedy and whatever happened. Do we believe on, did something happen on Air Force One that brought him back? Did something happen when he went, I guess, to Bethesda? Who knows? All right, now another thing about the diary, and then we'll move on to Booth's machinations after he was supposedly dead. Now just think of something. Do you think that having a blustery third week and weekend in April, that you would take off your ulsterette, your duster, and forget it? Do you think Booth forgot those items at Gambo Creek? Or do you think, and especially the diary, or do you think that was Booth's way of keeping the dogs off him? Because then Stanton had the indicting evidence, at least as a regard to what Booth might have written about Stanton and others who were in back of at least a kidnapping plot and very likely an assassination plot. So to me, it makes sense that Booth leaves, shall we say, quote, the goods, and it gets brought right to Stanton, and Stanton just grabs that sucker, excises a number of pages, and all is well. I think that was Booth's way of saying to Stanton, all right, I don't know anything. Let me be dead. I don't see any problem that whatsoever. Again, Stanton knew for the most part that Booth would not want to be found and would have disappeared and have been pronounced dead, and he was pronounced dead like right away. It was like, oh, yeah, this is Booth. Okay, boom, he's gone, bye. That's it. Nothing to see here, folks. Move on. All right. Surratt, he got wind of, no doubt, that had left the country and gone back into Canada and through Canada went to Europe. So, good. Now, Surratt's gone. Booth is, quote, supposedly dead. Boyd is dead. Harold is dead. Powell or Payne or whatever it is, he's dead. And I'm not even sure what went on with Powell and at the Seward's house. You know, Dave McGowan thinks there wasn't anything at all. I'm not sure if he thinks there was no attack whatsoever or whether it was Powell that executed the attempted execution. But we'll talk just a little bit more about that. I mean, there's so many crazy things that are going on about this. And the bottom line is, did anybody really try to make an attempt on Andrew Johnson? No. Did anyone make an attempt on U.S. Grant? No. They try to pin that on O'Loughlin, on a train up that Grant was taking with his wife to go up to Burlington, New Jersey. O'Loughlin on the train for as far as Baltimore, couldn't get the deed done. That proved false. So Azarot did not make an attempt on Johnson. O'Loughlin did not make an attempt on Grant. And nobody made an attempt or even hung around and lurked or skulked about the Stanton household. And that is also mentioned in a memoir from somewhere, I think, around 1908, about the youth that was indebted to Stanton for getting him a government job. And as soon as he heard that Lincoln was assassinated, he hightailed over to the house of Stanton, and nobody was around. And the bell that supposedly didn't work, which is why Stanton didn't answer the door so that his assassin could pop him, the bell worked. All right? One interesting thing is that Stanton lusted for a lot of things. He finally got on, he was appointed as a Supreme Court justice and died 4 days later. And you got to wonder if justice wasn't served right then and there, perhaps providentially or perhaps by the Jesuits, because Stanton ran his mouth about not liking Catholics. Not smart, Edwin. All right, so that's the whole idea about the leaving of the diary. Probably telling Stanton something. So in the end, Stanton doesn't want Surratt to come back, and that's why the United States did not prosecute him or prosecute the attempt to find him for prosecution. They had to take him back, grumpily so, but then he got a hung jury and he was gone, and it was an exchange. You shut your mouth and no problems, and that's what Surratt lived by, even though that the promise supposedly was broken that his mother would not be hanged. And who's that left? I believe. So you've got Harold dead, Boyd dead, Booth supposedly dead, Surratt's not talking, and you pretty much threw a blanket over any kind of attempt for others to turn the cannon at Stanton and saying you guys are the ones who did it. And that's the way it goes. In fact, I found the article I was looking for. This came, let's see, where is this from? The Sunday Star. Sunday morning, April 14th, 1918. The article written by James R. Morrow entitled Washingtonian Carried News of Lincoln's Death to Stanton. This is Joseph Sterling, who had been appointed to position, was in Stanton's debt, and this is his account. These matters I mentioned to give clearness to my narrative. I have been told, as I said, that Seward, too, had been murdered, and I thought it true. It has been stated that a broken doorbell saved the life of Stanton, that an assassin attempted to get into this house, into the house, but was not successful. There is no truth to that story. When Johnson and I reached Stanton's residence, I was breathless. Johnson rang the bell, and the door was promptly opened by Edwin Stanton, the son of the secretary. Excuse me. As I was exhausted, Johnson did the talking. "We have come," he said, "to tell your father that President Lincoln has been shot." Young Stanton recognized me and invited us into the home. We went to the library. Secretary Stanton had gone to his room for the night, but he soon came downstairs. He was a short, heavy man, and although slow in his movements, was restless and nervous. Now, all right, here's the reaction. This is Stanton getting the first word of what really did happen. He's waiting for whatever to happen. He knows it's going to happen, and I guess he was just going to go ahead and go to bed and hear about the havoc, or maybe nothing at all the next day. So listen to the reaction that Stanton has in the words of Sterling, who, I mean, obviously has no reason to think anything less of Stanton. All right, he said, all right, his voice was deep, his eyes were brown, and he wore spectacles. In periods of excitement or when irritated, he would thrust his spectacles upward to his forehead. At other times, he would take his handkerchief. His manner was brusque, and his countenance almost severe. I shall never forget his appearance that night. He fairly shouted to me in his heavy tones, "Mr. Sterling, what news does this you bring?" "The president," I replied, "was shot while at the theater, and I was told is dead." "Do you know who shot him?" he asked. "Yes," I answered. "They say it was a man named Booth, who sprang to the stage from the president's box with a large knife in his hand and escaped." During the conversation, Secretary Stanton walked back and forth across the room in great agitation. "As we were coming to your house," I continued, "a man informed us that Secretary Seward had also been assassinated, but that may be a street rumor and untrue." "Oh, that can't be so. That can't be so," Stanton exclaimed. It was at this time that Mrs. Stanton came into the library. "I must go to Seward's immediately," the secretary said to her. "Order the carriage at once." Mrs. Stanton tried to persuade him to remain in the house, pointing out the danger of his being on a street at that late hour of the night under all the circumstances, but he insisted that he must go. There was a ring at the door, and Mr. Stanton answered it, although Mrs. Stanton and I ran ahead of him in attempting to push him aside. The man at the door was the one we had met in the street. He was a clerk in the office of the Provost General and had come to inform Stanton of the assault on Seward. "Go quickly to Colonel Ingraham's headquarters," Stanton told the man, "and ask him to send a cavalry guard to my house at once." All right, so there you go. I mean, I just want to get that clear that that is documented, and this is in the memoirs of an individual who's a much younger person at the time. And there you have the rumor about Stanton being saved by a broken doorbell not being true, and Stanton's reaction to the president anything but mournful. All right, if you got the Booth 2 and the Boyd 2 map outs, we've gone through it a little bit, but we're going to pick up on a continuing path of Booth. What you see with Boyd, obviously, is the end of the road at Garrett's farm. He crossed over from, as we said, Nanjemoy Bay, landed just west of Matthias Point. Unknown what goes on for a couple of days. Ferries across the Rappahannock, probably April 24th, and goes right to Garrett's farm. And that's where the end comes for Boyd. We're going to call it a self-inflicted gunshot wound that occurred on Tuesday the 25th. And his body was taken out of there the morning of the 26th. And just remember that Booth's diary was already in Washington on the 25th, and Boyd had a diary, and so now they got, we got Booth's diary again, and we've been through that. Okay, now over to Booth map 2. You can see they left from Polk's Creek. They went to Mackadac Creek. Didn't like what it looked like there. Went to Gambo Creek. Then went west-southwest to Stewart's house, where he repaired Booth to a certain extent. Days later, they crossed the Rappahannock. That would be number 5, as you see on Booth's map. And then they follow the south bank of the Rappahannock into and through Fredericksburg. Now, the next map we'll go to will be Booth map 3. But I want to read something that sets up something of what is going to transpire. Now, two of the officers in the National Detective Police were the Potter brothers, Andrew foremost, also Luther. But this is Andrew's letter to a Edwin Stokes, and we'll just go with it. A little rough in places, but bear with me. I think it's interesting and also lays out an outline as to what happened or might have happened with Booth after he crossed into Virginia. Colonel Baker, he's referring to Lafayette Baker, did not write a book. It was written by a writer who got most of his material from documents Baker furnished him together with public print, mostly produced by Townsend. After what I have been through, I can see how it happened. The man who wrote did just like you are doing, and I do not want to produce a garbled mess of this type. Some things I can explain and will do so, but you are going to have to fill in the details from the stuff you have. And I'm going to just skip along a little bit to get right to the good stuff, not missing anything, and I can give you links to where this presently exists. Booth's diary had been found by the scout on Sunday morning and brought to me at King George Courthouse while he was eating breakfast. He told me that he had found it along the creek where Booth and Henson had rested. This diary was immediately taken by two detectives to Washington and turned over to Colonel Baker. He took it to Stanton that Sunday evening when Boyd was killed at Garrett's. His diary was taken by Conger and immediately brought to Washington and given to Stanton at his office at the War Department. Boyd's diary was more of a threat to Stanton and friends than Booth's, since Boyd had recorded details of his meetings with Stanton and Baker and had noted his many travels while he was supposed to be in solitary confinement in prison. He had told all about his activities in behalf of Stanton, Baker, Eckert, and others. Boyd had made up several diaries of the type Booth had with him. Boyd had got the diaries in November. That is the reason they were for 1864, and had made up a map for Booth along with a list of people he could contact for help, doctors, people who could supply horses, etc., all dealing with the abduction plot. He had also given Booth a map which had been marked for him. When Conger brought Boyd's book back to Washington, it was seen that it could never be released. Booth's diary was less damaging than that of Boyd. Booth's diary was an embarrassment, while Boyd showed the complicity of a lot of people in the abduction of Lincoln. It is my guess that Boyd's book was destroyed, but I am only guessing. Booth's diary could not be destroyed, but the story was arranged so that Booth's diary was the only one mentioned, and it was made to appear that it had been taken off the body at Garrett's farm so as to definitely identify Booth. That's where the problem comes in, because if they're trying to sell that, then how do you sell it if that diary being taken off that body at Garrett's farm, how does that get to Washington 3 days earlier? He said, and it was made to appear that it had been taken off the body at Garrett's farm so as to definitely identify Booth. It was Stanton's desire that neither book be released, but if one had to be seen, it should be Booth's. You will recall about Colonel Conger, that Colonel Conger posed as Boyd when he was inquiring about Booth. This makes sense only if it is realized that Boyd was in command of the abduction schemes, and it was rational that he would be looking for Booth amongst the people who were able to help him. What Conger did not realize was that Boyd had visited within those people, and they immediately knew that Conger was not Boyd. So he got no information out, only falsities. I previously outlined the route Booth took before crossing from Port Conway to Port Royal. I do not believe Henry Johnson caught up with them until they were across the river, that is, Booth and Henson. Johnson had picked up a Pamunkey Indian scout when he had first, this is the original typewriter from, like, you know, 19, who knows when, and it's kind of hard to read at times. When he had first landed in Caroline County, this scout furnished him with a horse and cart and helped him find Booth and Henson. When Conger and the troops got to King George County, they received conflicting stories about two men that had been there. This led them to conclude that they were being given false information, when in fact they were getting reports of two different sets of fugitives. When they had crossed from Port Conway to Port Royal, they had observed two men on fleet horses watching the troops unloading. Baker and Conger took to chase and went some 5 or 6 miles down a country road in pursuit before they gave up. They were lucky, for these were Mosby scouts, and Mosby was still at war. When Conger and Baker returned, they found that the lieutenant had dispatched a detail of a corporal and 5 troopers to follow two men and a darkey who had been in a cart and headed towards Fredericksburg. A darkie, obviously referring to a Negro. Conger was angry but ordered that the troops go on toward Bowling Green with 1 trooper left behind to direct the detail when it should return. When they returned, they reported that the men neither had a mustache, and that neither was David Herold. The black man was certainly a field hand. For some reason or another, Conger and Baker were looking for David Herold. At this time, neither detective knew that Booth had shaved his mustache at Dr. Mudd's, and they seemed to have taken the reward post as serious, since they believed that John Surratt was with Booth and Herold, and of course he wasn't. The three headed for Richmond. This is impossible for me to understand. This is Potter still writing. Circumstances being what they were, maybe you can explain it if you read the material. I would be interested in your opinions. So just reading that again, it said that they took the reward post as serious since they believed that John Surratt was with Booth and Herold, the three headed for Richmond. Why would they go to Richmond? Because Richmond, I mean, that's what he's saying. It doesn't make sense because Richmond had fallen and there was really no safety there anymore. It was no longer the capital of anything. Well, the capital of Virginia, but that's about it. Meanwhile, Luther Potter and I had gone to Fredericksburg from King George Courthouse and had stopped at a hotel for a night of much-needed rest and a good meal. We had gone by way of Belle Plaine Depot and had picked up from some fresh mounts and the latest information on the fugitives. We discovered that Conger and Baker had come down with cavalry and were going south toward Bowling Green. We figured that this would possibly flush the fugitives to the west, so we went to Fredericksburg. Inquiry there did not disclose anyone answering Booth's description going through, so we went to bed. The next morning we arose to news that Booth had been killed at Garrett's barn and his companion took alive. That's written there. Luther and I returned to Belle Plaine, where we discovered Baker with a body that had a mustache. In later years, we were discovered that Booth and Henson had passed through Fredericksburg while Luther and I slept. Henry Johnson had Booth and Henson in the cart, and the Pamunkey scouted the route. They come up the south side of the river and through Fredericksburg to the farm of a Mr. Howard, where they stayed for several days, were fed and rested. Now, you take a look at Booth map 2, you'll see that. And that'll be the last spot on Booth map 2, that we'll deal with. Now, after that, they continue westward. And so grab Booth map 3. So if you have Booth map 3 up, you'll see in the lower right-hand corner, that's where everything begins, and that's Fredericksburg. The question mark is Fredericksburg. So you can take a look at that if you wish while I go through this. All right. So they stayed at a Mr. Howard's. From there, they went on to the home of Dr. Almond in Orange County. A young Quaker doctor was there and attended Booth. He chloroformed him and redressed his leg, putting on a hard dressing after resetting the bone. In Greene County, they bought food from a widow woman and passed through Stannardsville. Now, on the map, you'll see Stannardsville is number 2, right? Oh, and we have Clark Mountain. That'll come in later because that's also fixed on another account that they have. That'll be good for that as well. But here you see Stannardsville, all right? And you can also see by the coloration on the map that they're at the what you would call like the foothills maybe you want to call it Piedmont before that front ridge of the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Shenandoah Valley, which is in between where you see Luray just a little to the left, or Luray rather, a little to the upper left of number 3. So you're dealing with a valley between two ranges of the Blue Ridge. So we have them at Stannardsville. while they had rested at Dr. Almond's, Johnson and the scout had made contact with partisans who took over the charge of the three men and led them to a cave on the west side of the Blue Ridge Mountain, where they stayed for several days. They were moved to the home of Lewis Pence at Mount Crawford. And again, you see Mount Crawford there. That's 4. The cave they're talking about is Bear Hole Cave. Now, they may have stayed at Pence's one night, possibly 2. And as Potter goes on, he said Pence took charge of them and took them to Harper's Ferry to the home of Booth's ex-wife. Well, they're calling her an ex-wife here, if she ever was his wife, but she's more or less considered his wife. We devoted one show to her. Her name was Isola. And she had stayed at, quote, their farm in Harper's Ferry, a piece of property that Booth bought from O'Loughlin, who will become Stevenson. And O'Loughlin had won it in a poker game. Pence had been a partisan and smuggler all during the war and had been a member of the partisan bank connected with Mosby and his ilk. He was a wily fellow, older than most, in his 50s, and he very cautiously took Booth, Henson, and Johnson north while the two scouts returned to the east. Pence took, the scout returned to the east. Pence took a route from Mount Crawford through Hopkins Gap, around the west side of Little North Mountain, to Matthias, nor through Lost River Country and through Bunker Hill to Bolivar Heights. He followed a route which would afford wagon travel but was not patrolled by troops and was free of Unionists. He was a perfect one for the job since he knew the country like his own bedroom and had been over it frequently. Such caution really was not necessary since to all the world Booth was dead. And if you look at that map, all those spots are contained there. And all I could do is the best that I could do with the directions I've got. Hopkins Gap, there's a Hopkins Gap Road, and I follow that to a certain extent, going from number 5, which is Little North Mountain, cutting up the east side of the back range of the Blue Ridge. And what's interesting, and I think that this is the case, where I-81 is now, that is that Shenandoah Valley. But that is very popular, if you will, and probably would have been patrolled by Union troops. Not the case on the west side of the second range of the Blue Ridge. So that put them on the outside as they went up to Matthias, which is number 6, then to Bunker Hill, number 7, a short jump then to Bolivar Heights above Harper's Ferry. Picking up from Potter's letter, I talked with Pence some years later, and you have a copy of the interview. He told me much off the record, and I actually liked him. He sat and talked for a whole afternoon, and I spent the night in the room and slept in the same bed where Booth had spent one or more nights. But Pence never admitted anything which I could have used against him, and I doubt that I would have used it had he done so. I was beginning to learn that the past cannot be changed, and after a few years, no one cares anymore. This is what concerns me about what we are doing. I have poured my soul out to you, and not only are you not interested, but I cannot seem to get anyone else to listen either. At this point, I have begun to doubt whether it will ever get published, even if I get it finished, which is doubtful. I'll leave it right there. So, I mean, here you see some frustration because Potter, for the most part, had the goods. And he wasn't the only one. There were a lot of people who eventually talked who were either involved with helping Booth along through Virginia or knew that he was being helped across Virginia. And I think I'll leave it there because in this next act, as we call it, next episode, man, does it get, I mean, it really is an adventure tale. It really is. And it is corroborated, it did happen, and we'll save what is off the maps that I provided for you. And I'll just say that this thing begins in Harper's Ferry. Looks like it goes up into Pennsylvania, into New York City, into Canada, down into the Caribbean, and off to San Francisco, really. So let's leave it here. This has been Mystery History Theater, and we'll continue it with the Booth's Escape.